The Cambridge Marketing Podcast with Kiran Kapoor. Brought to you by Cambridge Marketing College. See their range of courses and apprenticeships at marketingcollege.com.
Hello, I'm Kiran Kapoor, and welcome to episode one of the Cambridge Marketing Podcast. Coming up this week, my guest is Terry Nicklin from Keynote PR. And this week, we're going to focus on crisis communications.
It's a bit like talking about car maintenance as all being about breakdown management. If you service your car properly, you don't have to worry about breakdown management because you don't break down.
And we're going to look at how to handle media interviews with some very practical tips.
No comment is really bad news. You know, there's a red rag to a bull and it sounds shifty, it sounds evasive.
That's all coming up in the next 30 minutes of the Cambridge Marketing Podcast.
The Cambridge Marketing Podcast from Cambridge Marketing College.
So welcome to Terry Nicklin, owner of Keynote PR, a well-known Cambridgeshire PR agency. Terry, welcome to the show. We've worked together for a number of years now, and I know that you are passionate about crisis communications. Tell me, why is that?
Well, yes, I think crisis communications is one of those topics that gets a lot of attention, and rightly, because the effects of getting it wrong can be quite disastrous. Reputations that organisations have built up over decades or even centuries can be ruined in just a few minutes. If we think of companies, brands such as the older listeners will remember Ratner's, the famous self-inflicted wound there that caused the company to fold, in fact. Other organisational issues like Hoover's free flights promotion, BP oil spill, Brent spa disaster, all those kind of things, stick in the mind. And organisations need to understand how to monitor for brand issues and how to respond.
So I suspect you've probably whetted some appetites there. So for younger listeners, should we pick one of those and sort of explore it a bit further? So Ratner's, I always think, is the really fun one there because it was so completely and utterly self-inflicted. Would you like to explain?
Well, yes, I feel guilty almost putting the boot in yet again, because so many people have over the years. But it was an after-dinner speech by Gerald Ratner, who was the owner of what was then really, I think, the major or one of the major high street jewellers. There was a Ratner's on sort of every town centre high street. And I don't know if you've been to one of these. I'm sure you've been to many of these after dinner sessions, and you're expected to, maybe make a speech and say something witty, and everyone's had a few drinks, and everyone wants to be funny. And in his remarks, he mentioned that his jewellery, rings I think he picked out, was available extremely cheaply, and he said, it's amazing that we can sell these things. You may wonder, how can we sell a gold ring for whatever it was, £5 or something? And the answer is, he said, they're crap. And he said, they're about the same price as a Marks & Spencer sandwich, and the sandwich would probably last longer. So at the time, this went down really well. The audience loved it, very funny, blah, blah, blah. But of course, in the audience was a journalist who then wrote it up. Ratner calls his customers idiots, says his products are crap, and all this kind of thing.
And the one thing you're not going to buy is a gift that is described as crap, yes.
Exactly. Ruined the brand reputation. And he apologised and, said all the right things over the ensuing days, but that turned out not to be enough, and in the end the business did close. And I do feel very sorry for him, because I know exactly where he's coming from. I was in a very similar situation myself, actually. I went along to represent an organization at an awards ceremony, and we were shortlisted for I think about 5 awards, and we finally did win one, and I went up to collect the prize. And I mentioned in my comments, again, trying to be witty, that there you go. It just goes to show it's not the quality of your entry, it's the quantity that matters, something like that. Of course, we've been nominated for so many. And again, at the time it got a laugh. Next day, I got into work and I was horrified to find that a disgruntled customer had contacted our CEO and complained about the quality of our product, saying that even your marketing director thinks your products are low quality. He said so last night.
Oh, gosh.
Which was completely not what I said, but you can see how I let myself in for that one. easily done. Anyway.
Yeah. So how does a company prepare for this sort of thing? Yes, let's come back to a crisis comms.
The way to see it, I think, is that crisis communications is really only a little bit of a much broader topic of sort of issues management, and that in turn really is part of what we would call corporate communications management. To talk about just crisis comms, it's a bit like talking about car maintenance as all being about breakdown management. The idea is that if you service your car properly, you don't have to worry about breakdown management because you don't break down. So crisis communications really should be seen as part of the overall job that senior management has in leading the corporate communications for the organisation. And that goes back to the culture of the organisation. It's very different, I think, from most marketing, particularly product and service marketing, is something that the marketing department does. And the basis of it is the products and services, and marketing can decide what it wants those products and services to stand for. With corporate communications, you don't have that choice, really. It goes back to the culture of the organisation. What kind of business is it? How does it approach things? What are its values, its mission, and so on? And so that has to be owned, ultimately, by the top management team, and the CEO should certainly be heavily involved with it. In fact, these days, in terms of media management, you can't really avoid that. The media will demand to hear from the CEO. Which can be a bit tricky if your CEO is not particularly media friendly. So there are ways around that, which we'll come back to in a minute.
So I love the idea of crisis comms being sort of like breakdown management and thinking about the wider communications. That implies I need to do quite a lot of preparation on other communications as well.
Yes, that's exactly right. I think whilst crisis communications is often focused on that point of when all hell's broken loose and the phone is ringing and your social media team are saying, oh, my God, what's happening? We're being talked about negatively. Really, the job, the opportunity to get that right starts much earlier. And the first thing to do really is to understand what are the potential issues. And these issues might be active issues, things that are already going on, or latent issues. There's no evidence yet that there's a problem, but there could be a problem. If you think of a manufacturer, for instance, they could have issues with product recall, environmental credentials, even people who live near the plant complaining about the noise and the smell or something like that. It could be all manner of things which could come back and be issues to be addressed. And I think there's really kind of three stages really to issues development. There's the pre-impact stage before it becomes a problem. And that's about scanning the environment, understanding what the issues could be, and putting a plan together and getting ready for a possible crisis. There's the impact stage, which is where the crisis itself actually emerges. And you need to put your plan into practice. And then a very important readjustment phase afterwards, when you need to handle the fallout from the crisis. What did we learn from it? What damage has been done, if any, to the reputation? What do we need to do next to move forward from there, really? It's how organisations respond to these issues often that causes more damage than the issue itself. Let me give you an example of that. Last month, actually, Rolls-Royce announced 9,000 job losses, very sadly, and the CEO, Warren East, appeared on a BBC interview, and unfortunately, he appeared to be smirking. His face looked very much like he was smirking. He was looking at people off camera. He didn't seem to have all the figures available, and he got a lot of flack for that, widely criticised, including by Piers Morgan, who very vociferously criticised him. Social media said he was laughing with his mates, which I think was a bit unfair. I don't think it was his mates. I think he was looking at his advisers, who were probably, confirming whether he was on or off topic and saying the right things and so on. So, that was very sad, very, unfortunate, I think. And announcing job losses is always one of those difficult things. I want to come back to that in a minute, because it is it's something that is a very high-profile occasion and where the CEO normally is called upon to say and do the right things.
That's great. So what I wanted to do is look at the three elements that we need to do. So I thought we would go through each of those separately. So if you start off with really the identifying what the issues might be.
Yes, so a really good way of doing that is just to, and this can be done by, you know, one or two people, a small team or something. You don't need a lot of people at this first stage, and someone needs to really analyse what are the possible risk issues. Because, you know, all organisations manage risk. We all, as people, manage risk. Some risk is acceptable and some isn't. So we're trying to identify those risks which either have a very high seriousness or which have a high likelihood. So issues that are likely to happen and would be serious are obviously the highest priority. What one hopes, you haven't got too many of those. If you have, you might be in the wrong business. So you need to think about that. High likelihood, high seriousness, obviously, in draw a little two-by-two box. That quadrant is the one that's obviously the most urgent. But then we have the ones which are low seriousness, but likely. We need to plan for those, and we might already have some ideas how, you know, we live with that at the moment. But then the ones which are high likelihood, low seriousness, again, those we need to plan for as well. The ones that are low seriousness and low likelihood, we might choose to simply live with that risk for now. So if we take this set of issues, and we can get those issues in terms of what has happened before, what's happened maybe to other people, who would be affected by this issue, what would be the impact on the business. These are the criteria that tell us whether it's, you know, important or not. And then we can think about then what would our approach be? So, you know, if it were that we were a manufacturer whose products had found to be faulty, what would we do about that? We might, for instance, a good thing to do is to have at this point a team of people who are involved from different parts of the business. So we might have someone from production, someone from quality, someone from finance, whatever, HR maybe, and a sort of crisis team, so that we know that if something like this happens, if bad news starts growing very quickly, then we know what's going to happen when. And there's a famous diagram which looks a bit like a shark's fin. It's called the Hainsworth-Meng diagram for anyone who wants to look it up. I'm sure you've know it, Kieran. And it shows how the profile of an issue will start very low and raise slowly over time and then accelerate to the point where it comes to a very sharp peak, and that's the crisis. And then often it will fall away very quickly because people move on, somebody else has a crisis, or, you know, the world turns. But hopefully it's at the earlier stages of that growth curve that we can have most impact. We can understand what these issues are going to be and be ready. It might be, a good idea is to actually practice. Once we've got the crisis team together, ideally including the CEO, we might have an exercise. So we create a fictional crisis, a scenario within the business, and we challenge people to respond to that. So we might have some phone calls, we might have email requests, we might fake some broadcast media coverage, we might have some social media posts and so on, all fictitious, all within the business, but with executives then able to sort of practice how they are going to respond, and importantly, who should respond. And, you know, this is a 24-hour now news-driven society. We do need to have things like emails and telephone numbers of people who can be contacted at all hours of the day and night, depending on the seriousness of the issue. And that's what do those people say? Yeah, those people need to know, you know, what their responsibility is, what they're allowed to say, what they can't say, shouldn't say.
That's interesting. I know you wanted to come on to talking about how you handle media interviews, but before we get onto that, I wanted to ask about the readjustment bit, because I thought that was very interesting, and the bit that I've not heard people talk about with crisis comms. We always tend to get very excited about the media interviews and the actual dealing with the crisis, but the readjustment is a new area, certainly to me. So tell me a little bit more about that.
Yes, well, once the crisis seems to be under some sort of control, you know, the job hasn't ended there. We need to then understand what's happened to our reputation, really. You know, how is the issue currently or still being reported? Is there anything we could be doing now to make amends for any issues? You know, for instance, if an organisation has been found to be unethical in some way, you know, we might be thinking about how do we talk up our ethical credentials? Are there more things we can be doing to be seen to be concerned about a particular issue, seen to be addressing it and so on?
At the moment, we've now identified the people that are going to talk to the media, and you've said sometimes it might, I suppose, depending on the type of the size of the organisation, you might need to be available 24/7 as well, so you might want more than one person. So having identified your team, what do they, how do you then prep them? What are they then expected to do?
Right, well, that's a very good question. I think that the important thing is that they understand how messages can be framed and what kind of messages are required. They might, for instance, have some skeleton statements prepared, so statements which you know cover a wide range of possible issues and which can be then fine-tuned so they're not starting from a blank sheet of paper. In terms of messaging, I think the important thing is that there should, if there's some kind of problem, some kind of issue that the organisation is challenged with, then the organisation needs to act quickly, probably in most cases. I think there are some exceptions to that. But the organisation normally needs to show concern. You know, often we don't have all the answers. We don't even know if we are, in fact, culpable in this scenario. So we don't want to necessarily admit responsibility at this stage, but we do want to show concern that there could be an issue here. We want to assure people that we will be looking into it, that we'll make a statement as soon as we can when we've got some more facts. Our website should probably have some kind of holding statement to that effect. We need to have timely updates, because if there's any delay in getting a message out there, it allows speculation to grow and the whole thing gets much more out of hand than it otherwise needs to. In fact, it may even be, in some cases, it may be best to break the story yourself. If you know there's something that's likely to become a public story, maybe be the first to mention it and show how you're dealing with it. And that's a better thing than being found out and then having to be on the back foot and defending it, really. You're certainly looking at this stage to contain the issue, if possible. So show involvement, show concern.
And how do you prep for the media interview? So you think you've sorted it, you think you've got the messages, you've still got to control the interview in some way. So how do you do that?
Yes, that's a really interesting one, isn't it? And if anyone's done a media interview, particularly an unprompted one, unrehearsed, you know, it really can be quite challenging. And particularly, I think, with larger organisations and with high-profile organisations, you know, think of politicians, they can expect hostile interviewing. They can expect very penetrating questions and quite forensic analysis, and it's very, very difficult. There are some things that can be done. I mean, the first thing I think I would recommend anyone do is to have some main takeaways prepared. In other words, two or three key messages that you want to get across in your interview, things that you're going to say that you want the audience to remember. Now, you have to use those carefully, of course. You can't just keep repeating the same thing, because that looks very fake. You've got to weave it, really, sort of into the conversation in some way. You do need to certainly respond to questions. No comment is really bad news. You know, that's a red rag to a bull, and it sounds shifty, it sounds evasive. You really don't want to say no comment. There's a very famous example of this, if anyone wants to look it up on YouTube, by a guy called Dr. Hastings Banda, who was the president of Malawi. And in 1962, he was interviewed by the BBC. And in answer to most questions, he said, "I won't tell you that." And then whatever the question was, "I won't tell you that."
Have you come here to ask the Secretary of State a firm date for Nyasaland's independence?
I won't tell you that.
When do you hope to get independence?
I won't tell you that.
Where do you hope to get economic aid from?
I won't tell you that.
Are you going to tell me anything?
Nothing.
And in the end, the interviewer said, "Well, if you're not going to say anything, is there any point in carrying on this interview?" at which point it all rather fell apart. That's perhaps a classic example that stuck with me after 40 years. I can still remember. So anyway, what you do need to do, I think, is acknowledge the question. I would really recommend listening to Matt Hancock these days in his COVID briefings and various other things. And he is a I was going to say a master, but I think he's slightly wooden in the way he does it. But he uses what we call bridging. So this is where you're asked a question. It's not the question you want to answer. It's usually an awkward question, and you'd like to get on to your key takeaways. So you use the bridging technique, which is to acknowledge the question and then, you know, steer the conversation around to the point you're trying to make. And if you listen to Matt Hancock and just count how many times he starts his response by saying, "That's an incredibly important question." And he says that many, many times, and it's quite a good way of saying, yes, it's an important question, and now I'm either going to answer it or I'm not, but at least I've acknowledged your answer, you know, your question. And there's another lovely example I must share with you. If ever you want to brighten up your day, I sometimes click on this if I feel I need a lift. And it's another politician. It's a guy in Australia called Bob Katter. That's K-A-T-T-E-R. And he was asked about the where he stood on the issue of same-sex marriage. And he started by saying,
"Let there be a thousand blossoms blooming, as far as I'm concerned."
And then, literally in mid-sentence, his voice dropped about an octave, and he said,
"But I ain't spending any time on it, because in the meantime, every 3 months, a person is torn to pieces by a crocodile in North Queensland."
It was the most crude attempt at bridging I've ever heard. How you get from same-sex marriage to crocodiles tearing people apart in Queensland, I've no idea. But he did it without any smirking at all. It was quite funny. Another thing to watch out for, and a very easy trap to fall into, is repeating an interviewer's negative phrasing. So an interviewer might say something like, "Well, your performance is abysmal, isn't it?" And I think most people's response to that is to say something like, "Well, no, I wouldn't say it was abysmal, or I wouldn't call it abysmal," something like that. If you do that, you can bet your life that the next day in the news, the headline will be, "CEO denies his performance is abysmal." So now you've taken on the negative phrasing that was really the journalist's word, you know. So it's very tempting and to do it, but you just really have to try not to, and you have to say, you know, "I can't agree with that," and then you go on to explain why. So, you know, keep it positive if you can, really. And all that can be very frightening, can't it, particularly live? But actually, live interviews do have some advantages for the interviewee, although they seem quite frightening, and they are, because, you know, you don't quite know what's going to happen or what the question's going to be. But the pressure's also on the journalist. You know, the journalist can't edit what you say. They can't cut out the bad bits and make it look worse than it was. So it can be good from that point of view. And, of course, they can't stand a silence. They have to fill the space. So if you're quiet for a while, you know, it's the pressure's on the journalist to keep talking, really, and to fill the time. You certainly don't want to walk out of an interview, but that would also be a fear of a journalist, that the interview suddenly ends and they're left in the air with nothing, as has happened a few times, as you could probably remember, on the BBC.
Yeah, there's been a few politicians that have just stormed out. Terry, that was absolutely brilliant. I feel like I could tackle a live interview much, much better now. So thank you very much for your time and for giving us your expertise. And that was Terry Nicklin, MD of Keynote PR. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen.
The Cambridge Marketing Podcast. From Cambridge Marketing College, training marketing and PR professionals across the globe.
Thank you for listening to the Cambridge Marketing Podcast today. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. Don't forget to leave us a review and subscribe. That way you'll get the next programme as soon as it's ready. Next time, career routes in marketing. We'll talk about apprenticeships.
The beauty of the apprenticeship, so you can start your career with an apprenticeship, and you can also be working in a company for a long time, and you can also start an apprenticeship. So it's for anybody at any time.
And interim management.
You are being paid to bring that fresh perspective. The client's got all sorts of stuff going on. They can find it difficult to see the wood from the trees. There's lots of you know, there's just lots of day-to-day stuff that they are trying to deal with. And you just come in and you can just say it how you see it, and you can be really honest. And the worst that's going to happen is that they may not necessarily agree with your analysis.
And that's all on the next Cambridge Marketing Podcast.